Welcome to Circuit Break from MacroFab, a weekly show about all things engineering, DIY projects, manufacturing, industry news, and long-lived designs and complaining about Apple like we normally do. We're your hosts, electrical engineers Parker Dillman
and Stephen Craig.
This is episode 420, and before we get into the podcast proper, we have a platform update for MacroFab. We launched the enhanced inventory management system. We've always done energy inventory management in the platform, but we basically have a new display for it, and it handles overage, and it handles like how you, let's say you sent us some components for your inventory so we can store them and you can build out of them. Well, what now is when you place orders, it will show like which parts of that inventory is reserved for builds and that kind of stuff. And it will actually tell you consumption reporting and burn down reports and that kind of stuff. Mm. And then there's like an improved inbound shipment management too. So you can see like where your component is at in terms of when it's being received in to the HQ building.
So can you see when your part is picked for a job and when it's going to go out onto the floor?
It's, yeah, so it has like a reserved and then a work in progress section.
Cool.
So you can say, oh, you know, let's say you place an order and you need 20 of these components. It will reserve 20 of those for your order. That way you can like queue up multiple orders at once. And then the moment it gets kitted, it goes into work in progress. And kitting is when all the components come together for your order before it goes out to the floor or gets shipped out to a partner facility.
I can tell you from my side, things like that are absolutely wonderful. Given the job I work now, the parts that I deal with are considerably more expensive than previous jobs I've worked at. And so a lot of times I'll get asked by my project manager or by my manager or other people, hey, where's XYZ part? Can you give me a count on what's at your manufacturer, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when you have a reel of parts and every single part is $1,200, you want to know the exact number of parts and you want to know exactly where they are. And a lot of times when I'm asked that question, it's, oh, let me send an email to my CM and have them count it and tell me. But to be able to just look at my inventory and be like, yeah, I know they have this many and they're in this stage kind of thing, that's really helpful.
Yeah, that way you don't have to call us up or email, you know, Jerry.
I do think that's funny because a lot of MacroFab, I don't think you were intending for this to be the case, but a lot of MacroFab is set up for people who don't necessarily want to talk to people, or it's set up where if you don't want to talk to people, you don't have to, right? It's all in the platform right there. I think that's kind of funny how it's like introverts, CM, right?
It was planned that way.
Yeah, it was.
Just wanted, part of the initial was like never had to pick up the phone to figure out where your build's at or even to start your build. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting is I saw there's been this new term on social media in the hardware startup or just the startup space called hard tech. And people are like, we should have I saw some discussion about we should have a pizza tracker for PCBA. And I'm like, I just posted a screenshot. I'm like, we've had this for 6 years now.
Yeah.
We have a pizza tracker for your PCBA order. So you know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, you know what stage it's at any one point in time. Yeah.
Yeah, so this basically is the same thing. It gives you more visibility into your inventory that you have at MacroFab.
And you know what's funny? For basically no work from your side, you being the engineer at XYZ design company or whatever, it makes you look awesome. And I'm not just trying to sell MacroFab here. What I'm saying is, say that project manager comes up and says, I need you to run a report of how much money we have in inventory at our contract manufacturer. You do it in 5 minutes and send it back to them. You look like a rock star. And all you really did was go to MacroFab and just say, hey, give me the list of parts that you have.
See, what you actually do is you take 45 minutes to do it. Oh. But you get the information in 3 minutes from the platform.
Yeah.
And then you go and take lunch.
But you still look like a rock star because 45 minutes is still really fast for that.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
So when your boss comes in, you say, that's going to take a day. And you come back 45 minutes later with the answer.
Man, okay. Quick side tangent. I absolutely hate estimating time to do a task or a project or whatever. I don't know a lot of people who do like really enjoy that. I'm sure there's plenty of business guys out there that really get their jollies out of estimating time on projects and things like that. But I was doing some recently, and we were kind of looking at estimating time based on hours in a project. And a lot of times when I think about estimating time, I'm looking at, okay, 8 hours is a day's worth of work. But you're not constantly working on that project. So 8 hours, like if you say 8 hours on a spreadsheet somewhere, that doesn't necessarily mean I come in Monday and I leave with that project done, right? That 8 hours could be spread over 2 weeks because you're doing all kinds of other things. I don't know. I'm ranting a little bit here just because I've recently done that. It's so difficult to put down a specific number on this is when this thing that we know is going to take an extended period of time is going to take, especially with testing. Even if you write a full test plan and you kind of have an idea of this probe goes here and I press this button on this device and I do this kind of thing, it's still incredibly difficult to get anywhere near accurate.
Yeah, oh yeah, I agree. You kind of have to just do it. You can get better as you get more experience.
Sure.
And like platforms like Trello or Jira that can track time and statuses and stuff. But that's only as good as the data you give it. So you have to be diligent about, oh, like for your example, 8 hours over 2 weeks. You have to be diligent about not just leaving, let's say, a task in progress overnight or the task like just in progress for the entire 2 weeks.
Mm, yeah.
How we kind of did that was this is in engineering, we had our what everyone is working on board, kind of just like your current task. So it was a way so we could start measuring like workload and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We had more than two. We had a couple different like in progress statuses. And one would be like in process, like in progress, I'm actively working on this thing right now. Then there's also in process, like it's like on the back burner because it's like I'm waiting on something. And we had different statuses for like you're waiting on a customer or you're waiting on someone else at Macrofab or something like that. And that got us pretty good. But it also you have to be, you know, your team has to be diligent in doing it. And it's not something from micromanaging. It's just being like, OK, every engineer's got 20 different projects. How do you know that? What's the process of all 20 of those without having to bug that engineer?
Yeah, yeah.
And have a, you know, 10-minute meeting every day. It was a way basically to get rid of stand-ups and get rid of meetings and just be able to get rid of all that kind of just waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped a lot, yeah. But again, you have to be diligent, and it takes a while to get off the ground and get people used to, you know, when they task switch, they go and tell the system that they are task switching.
Yeah. Feels a little micromanagey. But
you could say that, but it opened up 3 hours every week for people because there was no more meetings.
Sure.
For that kind of stuff.
You know, so. Another thing is, well, that kind of a system I think works if whoever is managing the system itself understands the type of work that's going into it. I once worked under somebody who was very managey, very micromanagey, and they ran a Trello-esque board and had very explicit dates for every little task that you do, but didn't understand how engineering worked necessarily. So there was like, okay, this project kicks off. You have 4 days to create your schematic. So design your design your project, make the schematic. And on the fourth day, the expectation was the schematic is 100% done. And then you move into layout. And then you have 2 weeks or whatever to do layout. And, you know, at the end of 4 days, I had the schematic, but they were like, is this done? And I'm like, well, it's done, but I'm not going to tell you it's done because that's not how this works. And
change,
then by the time,
pinouts and
yeah, whenever I finished layout, they were like, okay, are you done with that schematic and that layout? And I was like, well, I have to go make my drawings for all the manufacturing files. So no, I'm not going to call both of those done until they're done. And then after that, I had to get all of it approved. So I'm not going to say anything's done until everything was approved. And then it all just in magically in a second, it all wrapped up and was all of the tasks were complete. But the manager didn't understand that you can call something done, but it's still open in a way. During your layout portion, your schematic is done, but you may need to go back and make adjustments to it. So it doesn't just fit cleanly into this bin of, oh, it's done and I will never need to see it again. And so I think engineering has a lot of wrinkles with that, and having a manager that understands it is important.
Yep. Yeah, that's why we never really track statuses like that, like individual tasks inside of a project. It would just be like the total project that the engineer is working on.
Yeah.
So, because each engineer has, you know, 20 different customers, and so how do you manage, you know, what the process is of all those?
Yeah.
How far along? Which one's stuck? Which one needs more help? Which one's behind? Which ones are ahead?
Which one's on fire?
You don't know. Yeah, which one's on fire? And you don't. So that way you can look at the board, and we basically just had a notification system that would have been like, hey, if a project has been in progress but been blocked by, let's say it was blocked by an internal customer, which would be at Macrofab,
right,
for longer than 2 days, then the manager could go and go, hey, I'm going to go talk to that one person that's the blocker and figure out why this is blocked and how do I unblock this so we can get progressing on this project again.
Right, right, right.
Whereas the only other way to know that is to have a stand-up. And if you're doing a stand-up every week, once a week, let's say on a Monday or on a Friday, you won't know. You just have this gap, 7-day gap of information. So it works really well. But again, you do have to be diligent. It's better when you don't have to micromanage the tasks. It's just the overall, what are you working on and what's the status of that one project?
Mm-hmm.
So keeping it like product progress tracker or just status of it. But yeah, we're not tracking like, is the layout done? Is the schematic done? Did you verify the document, like the test document? That stuff wasn't in there.
It's just higher level stuff.
Not even that. It's just building the test documentation and implementation and all that stuff for, let's say, Stephen Craig amps. Because Stephen Craig amps were building your stuff. And there would just be a top level ticket in that board, and you'd be assigned like an NPI engineer, and you'd be assigned a test engineer. But that test engineer is going to have that ticket and be like, okay, I'm going to spend probably an hour reviewing Stephen Craig's documentation that they gave us. And so he'll move it into in progress. I'm working on it right now,
mm-hmm,
and work on it. And when he's done, you know, if it's actually, and okay, well, the next step is we're waiting on actually getting in the equipment from Stephen Craig amps. So they'll take the ticket and go, okay, I'm going to push this in progress, but it's waiting on the customer to get us the stuff. So they'll just move it into waiting on customer. And they'll just type in a note, this is what I'm waiting on the actual equipment because we don't have it yet. That's it.
Yeah.
So it's just, it kind of just amass, like the ticket just kind of grows and collects all this information.
Yeah.
Just a history document. If you're an engineer, you should be doing that anyways, is like recording what you're doing on a project. And that's kind of what that does.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Is there better systems? Probably. But the development team uses Jira here, and it was like, well, that's just free for engineering to use. So that's what we used.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think when it comes to a project, the way I kind of prefer it, and you and I are talking about slightly different methods and industries here, but I like the idea that, say, a contract for a customer is written, or corporates come just out and says, I want a brake controller for this particular car. I want you to design that. And they say, you know, in the contract, we say, I want the first PCBs in my hand in 3 months. And the engineering team says, okay. And that's as much as needed, because then the engineering team, including your manager, sits down and breaks that 3 months up, and they figure out how when they need to have schematics done, when they need to have layout done. I don't like it when the higher level says you have 2 days to do schematic and you have 5 days to do layout. Blah, blah. Like that never seems to work. Just give me a date when I need to have a product or a PCB in your hand, and then I will work with my team to establish all the intermediate dates.
Oh, yeah, I agree on that side. Yeah, 100%. That's a higher level. Let's say the document drafter. That's how we can call that person.
Yeah.
Or the product. Let's hope if I have another P word. The product person.
The producter.
Yeah. I mean, because they're not an engineer, but all they care about is they get the PCB or the device by a certain date.
Well, yes, give me what that date is that you have to have that PCB or the product or whatever. What's the deliverable? Give me that date, and I will come to you on a very regular basis and tell you it's going well or it's not. And if you need more granular data about how it's going, I will tell you the more granular. But if you're okay with not getting the granular, I won't feed you that unless you need to know it. And you don't need to necessarily feed super granular dates down to me, especially if you don't understand general engineering practices for double E stuff. And that's not just me like being hoity-toity or anything like that. It's just like compartmentalize each department and let them run their thing because they know they're the experts at how the process flows through their department. Let them do that.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. You do have to have a way, which it's fine, except that you still have in there that if that person needs more granular updates, let's just say it's progressing well or not well. Okay?
Yeah.
Like a thumbs up or thumbs down on you hitting your dates. Okay? How do they know without asking you?
Okay. So I honestly think that is one of the largest jobs of what a manager does. So a manager is a middleman between the individual contributors and whatever other department is there. So the granularity for a manager is day to day, and in some cases, hour to hour. It is walking to the team and discussing what are you doing right now? How is this going? What is your progress? And then distilling that into larger packages of, okay, over 5 days, Steven or Parker got this chunk of work done, and distill that and pack in a nice way that makes sense to whatever department needs to know what the progress is. If I laid out a switch mode power supply and I got all my ground planes really nice, blah, 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 my project manager doesn't need to know that. But my manager might say to my project manager, we are 20% closer to being done. That's something they do need to know. It's all about who is your audience? What are you trying to convey to them? And to what level of detail do they need? And 99% of the time, they don't need as much detail as engineers are willing to give or wanting to give. So knowing how to break that down is a skill for sure.
Now, what if your customer isn't in your company and it's because you are doing something for an external customer?
Yeah.
And now they're tying up your support and your sales lines trying to get information.
Well, that's just a bad customer. Once again, I think
that's what we're trying to do with the McAfee platform, is so you don't have to. The more we can record stuff and make it easier to record that information and then trickle that information to the customer so they know how well or bad their build is going, that's, you know, even better.
You know, okay, so I've been on the MacroFab platform a bit, but I haven't explored recently. Do you have the ability to set up different dashboards for people?
No, not yet. We have a dashboard, but it's not like a customizable dashboard.
Yeah, okay, so, just an idea. Say I have a login to my MacFab account, and I can see all of this information, but the client that I'm making a board for wants to see some of that information as well. I could make them a dashboard and send them a link, and that's just something that they could view, and they don't have any editable things, but, you know, maybe the client sent me some really expensive parts or something, and I sent them to Macrofab, and the client's, hey, I want to be able to see them at Macrofab. I could send them a link, and it shows their parts that they sent to me that you guys now have. I don't know. It's just a thought. That could be something that's cool.
You could do that with other services, sure, and just using the Macrofab API, basically.
Yeah, to get that information. You could build that.
Yeah, you could build that with something like Retool, which is like an online app builder.
Right.
That you can basically glue a whole bunch of APIs together and databases. So you could hook that up to the Macrofab platform with your authentication and pull that information in and just show a inventory dashboard for one component for that customer. You can
do it that way. I know what I was just saying there is very extremely specific. Out of, you know, all customers, there's probably only a very few number that would apply to. It's still, I don't know, it'd be a cool idea. I could see that being a cool idea, splitting up based off of your role at a company. You know, purchasing sees this, engineering sees that, management sees this.
We already kind of have that.
Yeah, and I remember when I was working there, you guys were setting that up.
Yeah, we have different views, so to speak, for procurement and, well, procurement / purchasing and engineers in organizations. But nothing like what you're talking about, though.
Yeah, and until recently, I haven't had a need for that kind of stuff. Most of the time that I've dealt with customers, a regular meeting with them and a PowerPoint slide saying, here's how we've managed your stuff, is usually good enough.
Yeah, it's just I see a lot of people talking about wanting the information right away and not wanting to talk to people.
Well, and to kind of tie it all back, that's what your inventory system allows you to do, right?
Exactly. And I was just thinking about this, but because there are a lot of customers that are old school in terms of they want to call and talk to someone or email in. What if I just connected that to? I wonder if you used 11 Labs, which is a AI service that you can basically clone your own voice. That's what I used for the charity stream last year, where it was Darth Vader was reading all the call outs from people. I basically made a clone of Darth Vader's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could put a clone of my voice, and it could be me talking to you over the phone, reading basically what the Macrofab platform says.
I wonder if you did that, I wonder if people would be okay with that or if they'd be upset.
I think they wouldn't know, and then the moment they figured they knew it was an AI, they would be upset.
Yeah, I agree. So there's this concept that if you call a company and an actual human being answers the phone, then like you get excited and they feel like old school good customer service when that happens, right? And you kind of got to the point where you expect if you call a large-ish company, you're going to get whatever telephone service they have, and then you got to deal with that forever. But is that the next step of pissing people off? It's just you do get a human, but it's an AI human. And I don't know. That might actually work. That might not actually piss me off because I can interact with it like a human and get what I want as long as that all works. I don't necessarily care.
Yeah, I don't care either because all I care about is just getting the information I'm looking for as fast as I can.
Yeah, the end result.
Yeah, that's like when I call, let's say, AT&T because my internet is down or messed up or something's wrong with it. The first thing I do when I call these big companies is I just mash the zero button a bunch.
Yeah.
So I try to get an actual human being on the phone.
Sure.
Because I know the going through this, the pressing all the buttons and typing all the information in, it's going to take way longer than when I actually get a human on the phone. So if I could skip to, so I'm just trying to get to the end where the answer is.
Mm.
I do see an A hooked up to it would probably not be good for data retention, though.
Do you have a
recurve? Think about how the biggest breaches of security is in just social engineering is the number one way of finding out. Yeah, hacking is mostly social engineering nowadays.
Or you just convince the AI to give you data that it shouldn't.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's if people are gullible is not the right word, but if people are susceptible to social engineering, I bet you an AI is even more susceptible to, because it can't infer, I guess. It doesn't get social cues from like the phone call and that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
So I would say that's probably your biggest risk there. Be interesting to try out though. Maybe if I wasn't in marketing now, I would build something like that just to try it out.
In some ways, I feel like marketing is actually an okay department to be in for that.
I guess. Yeah, because we don't have any AI chatbots or anything like that on our website. Yeah. Some of them are really good, like the Amazon one. When you talk to, like when you do their chat thing that's on their website.
Yeah.
And that's an AI bot. There's no one on the back end of that.
Yeah.
But some of them are pretty. There was, I think it was GM/Chevy implemented a ChatGPT bot for their website, and you could get it to compile and run Python code on the website.
Really?
That was pretty. Yeah. So it was pretty funny. You can get like the chatbot to execute code. So that was pretty good.
Yeah, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, that made the rounds when that. I think that was like earlier this year. I think it was in January. But yeah, some interesting stuff for sure. Yeah. So back to that is like, I wouldn't care as long as the information is, if that's the fastest way that company can get me the information I need, so be it. Yeah. Don't put me on. I'd rather not be put on a waiting list to finally get a hold of someone.
Yeah.
I've been on hold once for an hour and a half.
Yeah. Right. Right. AI would be so helpful for answering all the really dumb, simple questions that probably burn tons of time. Okay. we're going on all kinds of fun tangents here. But okay, think of this. When I go to a website for an establishment, let's say a restaurant, right? If I go to a website for a restaurant, the thing that should be on the front page of a restaurant is, what are your hours and where's your location, right? Because 99% of the time, that's what people
maybe
visit
also
your website
what kind
for.
Of food.
Well, okay, that's what all I'm saying is the absolute most critical items that are on there. Now, if you want to add your menu, or if you want to add, you know, your schedule of events or whatever you're doing, like if, I don't know, if you have bands that play at your restaurant or whatever. But what's the absolute most critical thing when you are a restaurant or something like that? Put that number on there. I bet you restaurants, it would be really fun to know how many man hours are burned every year from people calling a restaurant just being like, are you open? I bet you it's staggering how many hours there are, even for a 10-second phone conversation that somebody's just calling to see, are you open kind of thing. AI could take care of those kinds of things, right?
Yeah, and especially, let's say, like all these restaurants, if you Google that restaurant, it has its hours.
Yes.
And all that stuff right there. So that information is really readily available, and people still call in and ask, what's your hours?
Exactly. Well, but okay. So there are times when it's not necessarily super accurate. It may be a holiday and you're not sure, or Google says holiday hours may be different or something like that. An AI could just be like, yep, we're actually closed. Sorry.
It's hooked up to the on sign on your
neon sign.
Yeah, the on neon sign or open neon sign.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just hooked up to that.
So let a human answer the hard questions. Let an AI answer the dumb ones.
That's a product right now. Okay. That is an on sign or an open sign. Yeah. I don't know why I keep saying on sign. An open sign that's hooked up to like an IoT open sign. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's hooked into your POS system and for the call system.
Yeah. And if the open sign is on, the chatbot will say, yeah, come on in. We're open.
Yeah. The phone tree will say we're open.
Right. 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 That is a product.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that has to exist, but make it simple like that, where if the on, if the open sign is on.
Yep.
Then it says that we're open. And if it's off, it says that we're closed.
You see, we're solving the real problems in the world
here. But making it super simple. So it's not like some other system that you have to log into or like a button they have to press like on the computer or whatever. It's literally the sign turning it off and on.
Yeah. And you know, okay, a little bit further than that. If you call, have you, when was the last time you called like a Target or a Walmart and asked them if they have something in stock? It's been a while, right?
I would say I can't remember because usually I go onto their website and see if they have it in stock or not.
Yeah, but an AI could do that as well, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing saying that. I don't know.
It's like, more useful for grocery stores because let's say you're looking for one particular sauce.
Yeah.
and it might be like, I mean, you know how big HEBs can get, grocery stores in here in Texas. And onto the HEB website and going, okay, I'm looking for this sauce. What aisle is it in?
Well, okay, so anytime you call one of those big stores, you always have to do the whole dance of, can you please connect me to the electronics department? You know, you always have to do that because the first person you talk is 100% guaranteed to not be able to answer your question, right? But AI could just do that, right? It just knows the inventory and it could just spit it out for you. Just on the website, but
we should get onto the real topics. But I'm wondering this, what we just said. I wonder how the people who hate AI just because it's AI is going to defend that idea.
Yeah.
Or attack that idea. Because there are some people out there that just AI, I hate it. So
just arbitrarily.
Yeah, arbitrarily.
Right.
Why is people are so like black and white nowadays?
Yeah, I don't know. There's polarized, right?
Polarizing. Yeah. People need to have more than one bit of color.
Gray is a nice color.
All right, so 36 minutes in. So our first topic that's actually on our list to talk about today, not our dive into AI chatbots and MacFab platform updates, is this is a really cool article I found on Hackaday, but it's from the Autopian. You're right, that's what it is. It's about a person named John who basically rebuilds a short-lived add-on or option for GM Toronados from like, I think it's like 1989 to 92. 3 years, you can get what was called a VIC, a Visual Information Center, inside your GM or Oldsmobile Toronado. And this predates those tablets that are like glued to the dash of every single car nowadays by 2 decades. Okay.
Yeah.
And basically, it's a CRT touchscreen that has controls for HVAC, has a trip computer, compass. They also integrated the car phone because this is 15 years before a cell phone was even a thing, let alone like everyone having one. But this is like an article about repairing them and what John does to repair them. Mostly it's CRT repair because most of the time it's just like the control circuitry goes out and they have to replace some components. Most of it's like electrolytic capacitors, a lot like amplifier repair. Most of the time you're just replacing, you shotgun all the capacitors, resolder everything, and it comes back to life.
I love the old CRT stuff, especially with electrolytic caps, because you can see the caps go bad because the screen just starts to wobble and flicker. And you could just look at it and be like, yeah, I need to replace caps. It's time.
Yeah. But it's a really cool, I knew they had CRT, GM did this. I went down like the rabbit hole reading about the VIC system. But what's even cooler is they even had a short-term pilot program with GPS navigation down in Orlando, Florida.
Hmm. Back in the early 200,
90s? Yes, in 92.
Wow.
I think they built like 200 of these cars. And like Avis had 100 of them that you could actually just rent. And it had this GPS system into it. And it was like a combination of using like the car phone for data and the GPS system. Because you could also get just like a modern like Android Auto setup or a modern navigation, you get traffic updates.
Mm.
And it would know that you were like off route. And if you needed help, it was kind of like pioneering their also their OnStar service. Because if you needed help, you could just click the help button on your dash and it would call AAA for you. And they would know where your location was and let you get and help you get back on the on track, basically.
Right, right, right. I wonder what the resolution of it was. Because I mean, GPS is kind of crazy now. GPS is what, 6 feet now or whatever?
It's less than that.
Well, I mean, correct. It is less than that, but they don't necessarily give you that much resolution if you go to Google and whatnot. But regardless, I wonder what it was at this time.
Yeah, I think it was definitely probably like 30 feet or so. But if you look at the roads that's being displayed on this CRT monitor, they're not particularly super high res. It looks like a vector screen.
Yeah, it is a vector.
I don't know if they were drawing them a lot as a vector display or they were rasterizing it. I don't know that. But it would be cool if it's a vector.
That would be really neat.
But they're color displays, so
they're touchscreen too.
Yeah, they're touchscreen. They had colored vector displays, so I don't know if they were vector or not, but. Really cool system. Everyone that's interested in like weird automobile stuff, definitely go check this out. But this brought up an interesting idea or topic I want to talk about is if you, so this is 34 years down the road, right, that these CRTs are starting to fail in these cars, which honestly – given the environment in a car with how many like heat cycles you go through in a day, that's actually kind of impressive for a TV. but if you were trying to design something, and that was the thing, like if you were designing the CRT monitor that's going in this car, like how long should the lifespan be?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because I mean, way back in the day, in the, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, cars were really only designed for 3-4 years max. If you got like 50,000 miles on a car, that was a lot of miles for a car back then.
Yeah.
And engines didn't last as long. In the early days, engines didn't even have oil filters, a lot of stuff. And nowadays, if a car doesn't hit 100,000 miles, it's a bad car, bad design.
Oh, yeah.
And you could even say double that. If it doesn't hit 200,000 miles, it's not even worth buying. Now, and most people are keeping their cars for seven to eight years now for the first owner of that car. And it's going to live 20 more years later in the secondhand market. So, but back then, it was still like, did you plan for a 30? Like, how would you even gauge that? Like, especially when like early on was like a low volume option. But on the other side of that is, let's say you want to design something like an end of the world electronic device where it will still work until the sun expands into a red giant and consumes the earth. How would you go about designing something like that? I mean, first of all, electrolytic capacitors are, you can't use those.
No, no. Okay, so it's funny. I've actually dealt a little bit with this recently. So basically what you're talking about is reliability. And how do you guarantee reliability for a long period of time? And on top of that, what you're really getting at is how do you calculate that you can guarantee reliability for a long time? And there's a handful of, frankly, not that difficult equations that you can bang out that says, you know, at the end of the day, what is your probability of failure at X years given these input conditions? Like how many temperature cycles it goes through every day and how many, what's its duty cycle of on? A car is not 100% duty cycle. You know, on average, it's probably the duty cycle of a car is actually probably pretty low because you drive to work, you turn it off, and then you drive back home, right? So all of these are factors that can go into these equations. But if you're looking at just a single point or a single, I don't know, circuit, the reliability, it trails off at a certain point. you just can't make something more reliable. You can only spend so much money. And that's when you start saying, okay, now we get into redundancy. And redundancy, like a dual redundant circuit, doesn't necessarily extend your life by a factor of two. It just adds to the equation that gives you more reliability. And so then you have to start asking, what about triple or quadruple redundancy? And so you build a really robust circuit, you test the snot out of it, and then you just multiply it. And frankly, to my knowledge, that's one of the easier ways to get more life out of something of this sort. And when it comes to the driver, let's say we were actually trying to make a CRT that lasts 50 years. The funny thing is the CRT itself may not degrade, might not be the key factor that degrades. It may just be, you know, the flyback transformer the flyback circuit that does the high voltage to it and things like that. So, you know, identify your key circuits, test the snot out of them, and then add a boatload of redundancy would potentially get you there. But the thing is, it's still only probability. And the way that you kind of work it out is you say, you give a probability number with a time input to your circuit or to your equation. So you say something like, at age 20 years, I want 95% of all of my product to still be functioning. So you have to allow for 5% of your stuff to fail at 20 years, because there is no such thing as 100% success at 20. You just can't guarantee that. But you can keep doing all these little tricks to bump that number up. And eventually you have to just assume the remainder is risk of failure.
So, yeah, because we talked about that with James Lewis, right, on a previous podcast. I think it was like Entropy Rules the World or something like that is the title of that podcast.
I like that.
But I'll rephrase the question.
Yeah.
If you were building an amplifier,
yeah,
that you wanted to pass down to your son,
yeah,
what components would you pick?
So what I first said is more of like the design equation side. And now you want to know more like exact nitty gritties kind of things. So obviously you pick components that you know are less temperature, to have less of a temperature dependence, and have nothing that can dry up, and have really good aging parameters. So film capacitors as much as possible, things that are potted. If you have something that is embedded in urethane, a lot of times that has a longer lifespan. Things that resist vibration, things that resist temperature swing.
Keeping the design cool.
Keeping the design.
Yeah, so like running undersized traces or underrated, but just at rate resistors.
Yeah. Also, a circuit that is used regularly, because one argument you could say, I wanted to make an amplifier that I would give to my son in 30 years. I wouldn't just make an amplifier, let it sit for 30 years, and then turn it on, because that's not reliable either. So something that gets regular use, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about, because I'm going to start going more into automotive OEM, like aftermarket designs for my electronics, moving away from pinball. And that's one thing I'm thinking about. I'm like, well, if I design, let's say, this motor controller, and in 30 years, I want that motor controller to still work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I? Because that's like the worst thing that can happen is if I build, let's say, I build like 100 of these motor controllers and sell them, and I'm using some of them, right? In 30 years, and if mine breaks, I can't replace it because it's like a, you know, bespoke motor controller, right? You know, so I would like it, from my standpoint, for it to last forever. And especially if you, like, make that as part of your sales argument, too, why it costs more, it's more expensive, is we are using these components for longer life. You can't say it can last forever because, as we were talking about, there's odds,
yeah,
that something will fail or...
You can stack the odds in your favor.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting to think about, because my computer for video gaming at home, we were talking about this last year, beginning of last year, that computer was starting to fail.
Mm-hmm.
It was having weird issues with its hard drive, and we couldn't, and it, I think it spanned like a month of podcast episodes where like I was bringing on my the laptop floor. Home. Yeah. It was sitting on the floor like with all its guts hanging out because it worked that way.
Yeah.
And then the moment you reassembled it the normal way, it would exhibit the same problem. And it ended up being like the South Bridge failed. So everything that runs off the South Bridge on that motherboard is just dead. But there's some SATA ports that run on the North Bridge. And if you plug into that, it works just fine. And it doesn't care. And if you use the lower PCI Express lines, doesn't work. If you use the upper ones, totally works fine.
That's weird.
And so I reassembled it in a different configuration. Still play games on it every single day. But what's interesting is that motherboard, I bought it. Geez, 9 years. Is it almost 9 years old now? And it's an Asus TUF. And the selling point was it doesn't have electrolytic capacitors on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was bitten by, a long time ago, capacitor plague was like a big thing in motherboards. It probably still is now. I just not in that news sphere anymore. I'm an enthusiast computer technology nowadays. But anyways, back in the day, electrolytic capacitors, there would always be like a bad batch and motherboards would just fail. And so I bought this TUF motherboard because it quoted, what was the quote? Solid state capacitors.
Yep.
Which means
yep.
What? Probably tantalum?
Those were more expensive, so I really doubt it. It probably just tantalum.
Yeah. And I don't know what caused the South Bridge to fail on the board, but it did last 9 years or 8 years before it started exhibiting problems, which is the longest I've ever had a motherboard last.
Mm.
So there's that. But definitely was not an heirloom motherboard, though.
Yeah. I don't know. It starts to get difficult, especially with computers, because they are way more of a higher duty cycle product. They remain on a lot longer. So they're in... You know, they're functioning all the time, and that just leads to wear, right? So 9 years sounds actually like a pretty long time for something like that to continuously function. Like I said, I don't know how much better you're going to get than that without doing redundancy.
Yeah. So that's going to be interesting looking at. I mean, I agree on the motherboard side.
Yeah.
It's just the automotive side. I think what I'll do is I'll make up my first design and we'll rip it apart and figure out how to make it last longer without. Go ahead.
Simplicity helps so much because the fewer items you have in there, your probability of survival goes up. One of the main drivers in reliability is part count. The more parts you have, because if you think of everything as a system, you ask the question, what is the probability of a failure? For every part that you add in there, you add probability of failure. Now, you have to define what a failure means in that sense. Okay, let's say you have a TV with 1 million LEDs on it or 1 billion LEDs on it. If one LED fails, is that considered a failure?
Oh, yeah, the whole dead pixel argument.
Right. Is that considered a failure? If so, I bet you if you run the reliability calculation on TVs, you get abysmal numbers just because of the part count. But their reliability is actually a lot better than that. So the calculations actually do start to fall apart when you have trouble defining what failure means. But in an automotive sense, you end up having a lot fewer functions that it does, right? It's not like you're not doing 1 million things, you're doing 15 or whatever. So what's nice is in your case, you can rely a lot on those calculations because it is way more stripped down and you can define what a failure means. If this output just stops doing the output, that's a failure, right? And I'm assuming a lot of the stuff that you wanting to design probably doesn't have a lot of, maybe I'm wrong here, but probably doesn't have a lot of analog control, right? It's probably a lot more digital or just binary on off kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, the outputs. Yeah. The inputs are mostly analog though.
Well, you have sensor readings and things like that.
Right? Yeah. You're reading sensors that are usually like 0 to 5 volt sensors.
Right. So one thing you can do to increase reliability is do what's called an EPSA, electronics parts stress analysis, where you take every single part and you say, here's the max rated from the customer, or not, sorry, the manufacturer. Here's a resistor. It says that it can handle 1 watt. Wattage am I running this resistor at? Am I running it at 1 watt? Is it at its maximum rated? Well, it will have a degraded life compared to if you're running at 700 milliwatts or if you're running at half a watt. And so what you can do is do an EPSA where you arbitrarily pick derated values. So say a ceramic capacitor. Let's say you want a ceramic capacitor. I'm just going to pick a random number. Let's say a cap that's on a 24-volt line. That cap has to be rated for at least 24 volts. So you could pick a 25 volt cap, right? Because that technically meets derating, or not derating, that technically meets the maximum rated. But it might make more sense to pick a higher rated cap, or, you know, pick any parameter, derate it by a certain amount, and you can actually extend the life of that component. And so if you want to get further reliability numbers, or if you want to get further life out there, pick arbitrary, or you know, go do some research on, you know, industry, what their derating values are. A lot of times with this stuff, it's just 50%, 50 or 60%. A lot of times with things like tantalum capacitors, it's actually 30%. You derate all the way down to 30% of the part, and then you get extended life out of it. So there's a lot of little tricks like that where the circuit doesn't change. You just pick an appropriate component based off of what kind of lifespan you're trying to get out of it. So there's really fun, if you really want to put yourself to sleep, there's fun documents out there that just go part by part that says ceramic capacitors, here's their derating values. Bipolar junction transistors, here's their derating values, blah, blah, blah. And just hundreds of pages of, if you got this, run this test, do this derating. If you got this, you know. I could show you those if you really want to fall asleep. But actually, you know what? That would be a fun thing to do. If you come up with a design, it would be fun for us to do an EPSA analysis.
Yeah, on that. Yeah, we can do it as an exercise. I don't know if that would make great podcast content. If
you know what might make fun? Doing it live would be awful content. But what might be fun is doing a first stab at a design, and then you and I do the analysis and see how close did you get to derating in a high reliability application with your first gut check on parts, and then come back and say, we had to change this and this. Now, it's really difficult to say, because we changed these things, you'll get an extra 5 years or 10 years of lifespan. It's really difficult to put a number on that, but you can say that you at least analyzed it for higher reliability.
Yeah, yeah. Well, looks like I need to start that design then.
Yeah. I'm excited now. Let's do this.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I don't know if there's any breakers still listening, but would you want us to do a podcast episode about that? Let us know in the discussion, forum.macfab.com. So we have this other topic. We can just go right into it. It'd be a long episode.
I'm going to say, because we're at an hour, let's push this one. Let's go ahead and leave this for another time.
That'd be the first thing we'll talk about next week.
I think that works.
Yeah, it's the Justice Department sues Apple for monopolizing smartphone markets. So we'll talk about that first thing. We won't get sidetracked for 30 minutes talking about
project management.
AI. Yeah, project management with AI. So thank you, everyone, for listening to Circuit Break from MacFab. We are your hosts, Parker Dillman.
And Stephen Craig.
Later, everyone.
Take it easy.
Thank you, yes, you breaker, for downloading our podcast. Tell your friends and coworkers about Circuit Break, the podcast for MacFab. Please, we need more listeners.
Also, go give us a review.
Yeah, give us a review. I think there's a link. We have a new email newsletter now. I don't think you can immediately sign up for it yet, which is not good, but it exists. And I bet you some listeners here got that email on Monday. But there's a link in that email that will send you to Apple to review us. I don't know if there's other places where you can review us, but please review us. We need more listeners. Everyone out there that listens right now is very loyal. You'll listen to every single word that we say. Even this word right here. So if you have a cool idea, project, or topic you want us to discuss or the community to discuss, let us know. It's forum.macfab.com where we talk about personal projects, discussions about the podcast, engineering topics, and news. That's forum.macfab.com. And I just fixed it. It used to, if you just went to there without logging in, it would only show you half the content there. Fixed it. So now you see everything. If you can go there without even logging in and just, you can view, you can like peep in through the window.